Okay, let's start this morning with a word of prayer. We always need the Holy Spirit's guidance when we're talking about things of this magnitude. Our dear Father in heaven, we consider it an honor that in Hebrews 4 we're told to go to the head of the line and press right into your throne room whenever we need immediate consultation. This morning, we ask that you send your Holy Spirit to be with us and enlighten our minds. Where two or three are gathered together, you say you are there. We take you up on that promise because we will need you to guide us in our thinking today. In thy name, amen. Okay, today we're talking, this is the, for those of you who may not know, this is the fifth in a series of 13 lectures. So we will be looking at different aspects of the genetic code as related to the Bible. And today we're going to be talking about in the garden. Review, which was in lecture four, and as I'm going through these different lectures, I try to give a small review of something that was highlighted in the last lecture that we're going to use in this lecture to kind of bring people up to speed. G-coupled proteins are a very important aspect of the communication within all mammals, but specifically in humans, is extremely important. And they are a system I'm not going to take a lot of time with, but as you can see that it's really a protein that folds on itself and goes back and forth through the membrane 3.5 times. It has 7 folds to it. And when any type of, and we're going to talk about those just briefly here in a second, if a biological chemical comes in and fits in like a lock and a key to that outer green kind of fluffy area up there, it will change the conformation of the protein so that it will expose on the inside of the cell it will change the conformation to reveal an active site, and it will catalyze the it can be a kinase, it can do multiple different chemical reactions to other enzymes that are sitting in the inside the cell, and in the process activate them. So this is what G-coupled proteins are. G-coupled protein receptors are found only in eukaryotes, including yeast and animals. The ligands that bind and activate these receptors include light-sensitive compounds. In fact, that's how they discovered it. The light-sensitive compound rhodopsin is a G-coupled protein. So it helps us without that dealing with photons and everything, we wouldn't be able to see. Odors, pheromones, hormones, and neurotransmitters. All the neurotransmitters are G-coupled proteins. And that's going to be very important here as we go forward. And vary in size from small molecules to peptides to large proteins. G-protein coupled receptors are involved in many diseases, and are also the target of approximately 40% of all modern medicinal drugs. The G-coupled protein system in our body, they've discovered 1,400 so far, and there's more. But dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, epinephrine, gamma-aminobutyric acid, the list goes on and on and on. All of these work on a G-coupled protein. Now, this is an important paper, and I'm putting this up there for those of you who want to look into this further. G-coupled proteins have been, well, let me back up. There's a debate right now as to whether G-coupled proteins are the result of pseudogenes. Remember, we talked about those last week. Those are genes which have been brought in horizontally by mobile genetic elements, or they have been protein coding areas in the body which mobile genetic elements have I'm going to use a regular term here, sabotaged, that they've taken them over. So they don't know whether G-coupled protein is something that was purely the etiology was purely mobile genetic elements, or if mobile genetic elements have been wildly successful in taking over the system and reshaping it into the way that they are dictating. And this is a great article. It goes over through a number of areas. And of course, it looks at rhodopsin, which was one of the first G-coupled proteins that was discovered. If you own the G-coupled protein panorama of different receptors, I can't think of anything you can't do in the body. You really have hit jackpot. You've really hit the jackpot if you can get this system and control it. And nobody argues that mobile genetic elements are in control of them. No one that does the research that has published the papers. They are, from all intents and purposes, and when you look at it, you would guess that it seemed to be entirely under the control of them. That is, they have taken over the system to that degree. Now, up until this lecture, we've learned about information theory, we've learned how that works with our genome, and we've applied that. And then we have looked at the genome itself, and we have found that it's absolutely riddled, up to probably about 85% of our genome was added, and it was added in the form of mobile genetic elements. And last week, we talked about that ad infinitum. Well, now today we're going to say, okay, how did those mobile genetic elements get into our genome? What is a possible way? And science has nothing to answer on that. Right now, nobody knows. We talked about this last week, the hallmark genes that are required to get the endonucleases, the integrases, and the reverse transcriptases that you have to have a takeover by the mobile genetic elements. Though there is no correlate in the rest of living organisms, there's no correlate to those enzymes. They stand alone. There's nothing they could have evolved from. They're de novo. They're new. And so science has no explanation as to where mobile genetic elements have come from, nor how they appear to be, at least, so well engineered to do what they've done. So now let's look at the garden story, because my hypothesis is I think the Bible can shed a lot of light on this subject. And I'm going to present to you for the rest of the time this morning why I think so. What was the actual temptation? A lot of people think, well, Eve in the story, if you recall, she's wandering around by herself. She chances upon the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And as she's doing that, as luck would have it, a serpent flies into the tree, starts eating the fruit, and starts talking to her. And it's clear from this, at least inferred from the story, that serpents weren't talking prior to this, and so it caught her attention. And as the story is normally told, that the serpent tempted her because she was hungry. He tempted her to eat some fruit. Well, I think that's an indefensible position, because if she's walking around in the Garden of Eden, and let's just for argument say there's 500 trees of different types of fruit and grapes and all kinds of nuts and wonderful things to eat. There's no way you're going to persuade me that she's gone without food for 24 hours and is famishing and has a low glucose level in her bloodstream and is now at desperation corner and needs something to eat. And the serpent says, here, I've got some food for you to eat. And she goes, no, God says we're not supposed to eat that, but oh, I'm so hungry. It had nothing to do with her being hungry. Something else is at stake here. There's no way she's walking around with all of this food at the ready, and right next door is a tree of life. If she's really that hungry, go over there and have a pear. Get your blood glucose up again, and then come back and talk to the serpent. So this does not have to do with her being hungry and the idea that we always told, well, we have to curb appetite. Well, it depends how you determine appetite, because you see, all food that you eat, you're really ingesting information. So I'm going to say that I'm okay with appetite when appetite really discusses about taking genetic information in horizontally through the GI tract, then I have no problem with it. But the old concept that she's famishing, much like Esau when he made the deal for the lentils with Jacob, is just not the case here. And what was the adversary trying to achieve? Was he just trying to get Adam and Eve, you know, God made some rules, might be a little arbitrary in some of the rules, and Adam and Eve, the idea was just to get them to step over the line, and that's all he had to do? What was his goal? What was he after? And that's what we're going to look at. Okay, the story. When I was growing up, I understood the story. Well, I'm going to paraphrase the story. I'm going to modernize the story and kind of give you an idea of what I heard when I heard the story. Let's suppose that there's a husband and a wife and they have three children, 6, 9, and 12. And one day the husband calls the family in and he says, "Now listen, I'm the head of this household. I make the rules of this household. My job is to protect the household. And I need everybody to understand that I'm the guy that makes the rules, and I make the rules in order to make all of you safe and to show that I love you. But I've got to determine whether you understand that and whether you're with me on that. And so the only way I can do that is I'm going to put on here on the kitchen table two bowls of fruit. Now, I've clearly labeled this bowl of fruit on my right. It's okay to eat. In fact, you should have fruit every day, so I want you to eat it. And in this bowl of fruit right over here that's right next to it, you're not to touch it. Now, the fruit looks the same. But this is the way I'm going to determine whether or not you are a good member of the family, a trusted member of the family. Now, let me tell you something else. The consequences if you eat of the fruit here on my left in this bowl are severe. You don't want to do that. In fact, you can lose your life. Now, children, do you understand what I just told you? Have I been very clear? Yes, Daddy, we understand completely. Everyone understands under no conditions are you to eat the fruit here on the left bowl on my left, but you can. In fact, you're encouraged to eat the fruit on the right. Yes, Daddy, we got it. 2 or 3 weeks go by, and one day the 6-year-old runs into the house. She's hungry, and she looks in the bowl of fruit that's acceptable, and there aren't any apples there, but she sees there is an apple over here in the bowl, which they're told they can't eat from, and she just goes, "Well, Dad, can't really mean that, what he says. I really want an apple. Fruit looks the same. I bet it's, I'm just going to take it. And he's a good guy. He's a loving guy. He won't be any problem." She takes the fruit and leaves, eats it. That night, the father calls the family in. He goes, "I counted the fruit here in the left bowl, and some fruit is missing. Who ate it?" Silence. And finally, the 6-year-old goes, "Daddy, I admit I ate it." And he goes, "Did you forget what I told you about the fruit?" "Oh, no, Daddy, I know. You told us we weren't supposed to eat it. Bad things would happen to eat it. You clearly understood then you were eating the fruit from the wrong bowl." "Yes, Daddy, I completely understand it. Please forgive me. I'm sorry." And he takes out a revolver and he shoots the little girl in the head. Now, do you think the rest of the family is going to go, "Oh, Daddy, we really love you now. We see that you have our best interests at heart. And yes, we now know that these rules are for our good. That you, our love for you knows no bounds. We aren't going to, none of us will want to transgress ever again. We think you're great." Now, if you were a next door neighbor and he walked over and says, "I'd be willing to babysit your children or your grandchildren," would you let him? Then God's got a problem with this story. Big one. If we wouldn't let him babysit our children, then all the other statements he makes about being loving really are nothing but empty claims. So we've got to get to the bottom of what's going on here. Because if that story's true, we might as well disband this Sabbath school, and I know I got better things to do. So let's go back and read the story carefully. And the Lord commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that thou eatest thereof thou shalt surely die. Well, it really repeats the word die twice, meaning dying you will die. And notice that he says, thou shalt not eat of it. So he doesn't say thou shalt not touch it, thou shalt not think about eating it. He says the day you eat it. Okay, it's very clear. And the serpent said unto the woman, ye shall not surely die, for God doth know that in the day you eat thereof, your eyes will be opened, and you will be as gods, knowing good from evil. He goes, oh, no, that's not true at all. You really believe that? He says, I got to tell you something, it's completely different. You eat of that tree, and you'll go to a new level of functioning. One of them's lying. Because those two claims are diametrically opposed to each other. They're 180 degrees apart. Okay, what was the adversary trying to get Eve to do in the story? Remember, he flew up into the tree, started munching on the fruit. What was he after? Now these are going to be my paraphrases that I'm bringing in, because we've got so much to do today, I couldn't just put each one of the biblical texts up and then go back and forth. We're going to have to kind of motor through, and I know with that comes generalizations, but bear with me. He wanted her to rely on her own sensory input as the ultimate reality instead of God's word. And of course, we still have that situation going today, don't we? It hasn't changed. So he wanted her to say, look, don't just take what that guy claims. You have eyes and ears and a good brain. You can figure out for yourself what is really factual and what isn't. To doubt God had her best interest in mind when he forbade eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and he applied it in the following questions, and he did it very, very, very ingeniously, in my opinion. He starts out by saying, did God really say you couldn't eat any of the trees in the garden? And with that, he's inferring, you know, God's the creator of all the trees here. I'm not going to argue that, which I think that's interesting. The devil didn't come in and argue whether God was a creator of God or not. He gives that away in this discussion. He doesn't even go there. But he takes a completely different tact. He goes, God created everything in this garden, didn't he? Yeah. Yeah, Eve's agreeing. And he goes, has God ever treated you and Adam poorly? Has he ever been rude to you? Has he ever stood you up for an appointment? Has he ever been in any way physically injurious to you? No, everything has been really pretty good, wouldn't you say? Yeah, he's actually been very gracious. Yeah, Eve agrees. Has any of the fruit that you've eaten, and you've been here for X amount of time, has it ever caused you any problems? Even any indigestion or anything else, or has it always been positive? And Eve starts to think, yeah, it's always been positive. That's inferred in, you know, is it true you can't eat of any of the trees of the garden, the fruit of the garden? Is it logical then that a life-giving God would create a tree whose fruit had the power to cause your death and put it in the garden right next to the tree of life where you can't miss it? Given the fact that everything in God's creation has been for your benefit, would it not be logical to assume that the fruit from the tree of knowledge of good and evil would also be beneficial, not harmful if eaten? Do you have any evidence anywhere that anything that you've touched or been in this garden has been in the slightest bit deleterious? The answer, no. Well, that's the fruit of this tree is also good. Why would God, a good, gracious God, make a tree that brings death? And you may be wondering, well, I'd like to see some proof of that. And I'm providing that to you as we speak. I've already partaken of the fruit, and as can readily be seen, Not only have I no untoward effects, but I have actually entered a higher rate of existence. I wasn't able to talk before I was flying around. I was just one of the snakes. Maybe he was one of her pet snakes. I don't know. And now that I've eaten of the fruit, do you see any problems with me? Am I dead? Oh no, I'm not dead. I'm talking. And I wasn't talking before I flew in the tree. The only difference is I've eaten of the fruit. That's the only difference. I've done the experiment for you. Here is clear, incontrovertible evidence that what God said simply isn't true, and you're seeing it in front of you right now in real time. Since we're both created beings, if the fruit has given me greater intelligence, greater ability to verbally communicate, etc., what wonderful things might it do for you? Look, I couldn't talk and I flew in the tree and I ate some of the fruit. Now I can talk. You can already talk. I'll bet if you ate the fruit, why, you'd become like God. That's what he was selling. He wasn't selling her to try a new piece of fruit. Oh, come on, this is a great new piece here. It's going to taste really great. Or, boy, I know you're hungry. Here's something for you right now. He was selling her a new information system, and she knew it. Because how could a snake go and start talking to you unless it had the circuitry in the brain, which could only be engineered with the information system in the genome, as well as connections to vocal cords, which the snake, we have no evidence. They don't have them now, but we, there was no evidence, and the Bible makes it suggest that they were not talking. So there would have had to been vocal cords arrive on the scene, and you can't just have those happen. They've got to come from a blueprint somewhere, which would have been a genetic blueprint. What the snake was saying is, I have changed. I have new information system, and that's what I'm selling you in this fruit. And we don't know where you're going to end up, but you're starting up farther than I was, and that means you have that much further higher to go. Eve knew what she was doing. This wasn't some prank. She was buying into the fact that she wanted a new information system, or at least an addition to the one she had. An upgrade. What did the devil left out of this story? Conveniently. Himself. That's the unknown that he left out, which would have cleared up a lot of which would have changed entirely the whole scenario had Eve known that. So there is where the deception was. So Eve was talking information system. The devil was talking information system. And so we're going to talk information system. What was his goal? Disbelief? Yeah, he wanted her to disbelieve God. And he provided what appeared to be an absolutely airtight experiment where he served as his own control. Believe a lie? Well, this was a lie. Yeah, he wanted her to believe that the fruit carried a lot of great information, which I'm going to suggest to you it did not. He wanted her to disobey? Yes, he wanted her to disobey, but was that his end point? No, he wanted all three of them, but he wanted those to provide stair steps to get her to where he really wanted her to go. Now, if we look at the question, this just had to do with deception. That's all. It just had to do with deception. All he was trying to do is get them to believe a lie, and in the process of doing that, the mental circuitry of their brains would somehow melt down, and that would translate into genetic changes, and all of those, of course, we can't find any correlate in today's world that would support anything like that. The key is Adam wasn't deceived. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression. This is the American King James. If you go to the Good News Bible, it puts it this way. And it was not Adam who was deceived. It was the woman who was deceived and broke God's law. Adam knew what was happening. He was not deceived. He didn't disbelieve God. He did. He believed that what God said was true. He thought that death was coming. And I'd suggest to you the reason he did ate the fruit was not because he bought the story Eve told him about the serpent. It was because he knew Eve was going to die and he figured, I'm going to die with her. I can't fathom living here without her. That's why he took it. Romeo and Juliet story, sort of. Maybe Shakespeare got the idea from there, I don't know. In order to be deceived, one must first disbelieve God and then believe a lie, and Adam did neither. He knew what he was doing when he ate the fruit. And he still got the consequences. What was the deceiver's goal? For God does know that in the day, notice, you eat. Not think about eating, not think about touching the fruit. The day you eat it thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. That's what the devil said. The day you eat it. So he wants her to eat it. God told her not to eat it. And Eve, what does Eve think? And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree to be desired to make one wise. There you go. That was her motivation. She first looked at the fruit. Did it look bad? No. Did it smell good? Yes. So it wasn't spoiled. Why does she want to eat it? She wants to get whatever is inside that fruit because it's whatever it is, she feels it's going to make her wise. She took the fruit thereof and did eat. So everyone agrees that eating is crucial for this transaction to take place. God does, the devil does, and Eve does. All of them. And gave also to her husband with her, and he did eat. All three players in this drama completely agree that eating of the fruit is key to what comes next. The Hebrew word there for wise was to give insight, to teach, or to give comprehension. The only way that this could happen instantaneously, if it could happen at all, would be through a change in the information system of Eve, because apparently the snake, who had already eaten of the fruit, had developed vocal cords in the CNS circuitry to control them, and this could only happen via an addition to his information system. The temptation's final purpose then was not just to deceive her about God's character, but it was to get Eve to agree to change her information system. For that is what apparently had happened to the snake. Does sin have a physical basis, or is it just a state of mind? Well, in order to define something like this, you have to look, what are the parameters that affect it? How is it transferred? Well, through heredity, mobile genetic elements in the genome. That's physical. Why? As by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed on all men, for that all have sinned. Paul makes it very clear this is genetically transferred, physical. What are its consequences? Well, the first death, we talked about that in lecture 3, are clearly, unmistakably, 100% everyone that looks at it agrees are the result of mobile genetic elements. And the second death, which will be discussed in lecture 13, I'll give you a little hint. They're the cause there too. For the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ. Another way of reading the Greek is sin pays its wage death. Sin pays it. God doesn't pay it. Sin pays it. Is there something that can reverse this death? Yes, eating of the tree of life. And the Lord said, behold, the man has become as one of us to know good and evil. And now, lest he put forth his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever. So, I'm going to argue that sin is a physical problem. It's transmitted physically. The consequences it brings on are physical. And if you are going to give an antidote to get out of the system, it also is physical. And you define this concept by the parameters that influence it, that can correct it. So if a physical thing can correct the problem, then you're dealing with a physical issue. How could mobile genetic elements get into Adam and Eve's genome in the first place? Well, if you're awake, I think you know where I'm going. God and the devil, we have two choices. God and the devil made an agreement that should the pair eat of the forbidden fruit, God would remove them from the garden, allowing the devil to carry out his purposes. Okay, that's an option. I wasn't there, you weren't there, and our history as written in the Bible doesn't comment on this. Doesn't say if there was something actually in the fruit or if this was all just an agreement that could have been made between God and the devil. We have no comment, so we don't know. Our other option is there were mobile genetic elements in the fruit. We have two trees here, one each in the middle of the garden. If you read in Genesis 2 where it talks about God creating them and putting them there, there were special trees. They were different from all of the other trees. Now, even today, and I'm at the risk of repeating myself, even today, when you're eating fruit, you are mainly eating information, genetic information, which goes in and interacts with your genome. When you eat grapes, you get resveratrol. Resveratrol goes in and stimulates sirtuin-1, which is a protein coding area in the gene, which produces different proteins, which actually go stop something called mechanistic target of rapamycin, which is our aging big enzyme that causes us to age. See, that's how it works. Purely physical. Genetic, chemical, biochemistry, par excellence. So, what does God say about the tree of life? Well, he says, according to Genesis 3:22, which I just read to you, so I didn't put it back here again, eating of it makes you live forever. Even if you've done something you shouldn't have done, even if you've ingested fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Also, it says in Revelation 22:12, and the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations, including biological active ingredients in the leaves. So it's not just in the fruit. And as I said today, fruit is primarily important information that your body needs. Well, the fruit brings in the information that you ingest, does very wonderful things to your body, to your enzymatic functions, and to your genome. You're eating information. The fructose is to make it sweet, so you'll eat it. And that goes for all of our food, by the way. And that's why processed food is so bad, because all the information is processed out, and all you're left with is the energy part, which is what was to tempt you to eat the good stuff in the first place. Well, why couldn't there be something in the tree of knowledge of good and evil and its fruit? We've clearly established there are very active biological molecules, not only in the fruit of the tree of life, but also in its leaves. And God said, don't eat of it. And the devil says, you need to eat of it. And Eve says, in order for me to get what I want, I've got to eat of it. To me, it just seems logical that there could be something in that fruit. All right, but let's suppose there was some mobile genetic elements in the fruit. Could they have gotten in from the fruit, gone through the stomach, which has a low pH, somewhere around 2.5 or less when you're ready to eat a meal, and get through that acid bath, and then go through all of the different enzymes that are dumped in from the common bile duct from the pancreas, and survive? When I was growing up, I thought when I ate food, by the time I chewed it and it went through my stomach, it was broken down to the atoms, and then the body picked up the atoms and then reassembled them and put them together. I couldn't have been more wrong. It's exactly the opposite of that. It says here, this is an experiment which was done by four people are on the as authors, but two of the authors actually did this experiment on themselves because they went to an ethics committee to try to get permission to do this experiment on a larger group of people, and they were turned down because they said it was unethical. So the authors said, well, then we'll do it on ourselves and we won't be subject to this, and so two of them did it. And what they did was they took some rabbit meat. Well, let me read this to you. It says, few attempts have been made to study the transfer of DNA from ingested food across the intestinal barrier. A low uptake of ingested DNA has been observed in mice, cattle, and poultry. There have been no reports on humans so far. Maintenance of species barriers, now listen, protection against retrotransposons, those are mobile genetic elements. Anytime, those of you who were here last week, that should be sending off alarm bells. Optimization of oral DNA vaccines and the fate of genetically modified foodstuffs are issues where the topic is of importance. We therefore use the high copy number rabbit retrotransposon RERV-H and the rabbit mitochondrial DNA to study the transfer of DNA from ingested rabbit meat into the bloodstream of two human volunteers. So they labeled the rabbit, these are retro elements now. These are retro elements. Exactly what I'm talking about when I say mobile genetic elements. The mobile genetic elements in the rabbit they labeled, and they're specifically looking for those in the bloodstream of the volunteers. 1 hour after a meal of rabbit meat containing 10 to the 14 copies of the RERV-H, that's the mobile genetic element, DNA, a maximum concentration of 200 copies of this mobile genetic element per milliliter of peripheral blood was observed, which corresponds to the uptake of approximately 10 to the 6th of those mobile genetic elements. They were noted at 1 hour, and they were detected, and this is the important part, they were detected not only in the bloodstream, but they were also detected in cellular and in the cells and the plasma. So in other words, they ate some mobile genetic elements that had been labeled in rabbits, in the rabbit meat, and then they took their own blood and they found that a fair amount had gotten through. And not only had it gotten through into their bloodstream, but it had passed into the extracellular fluid and into the cells themselves. Okay, why is that so important? Well, they go on to say, the relative ease with which mammalian cells in culture can take up and integrate and express exogenous non-self DNA by transfection shows that cellular defenses against foreign DNA have their limitations. They're referring to a paper here, a couple of papers, and what happens is what the cells do is if there's free-floating DNA, you would think that the cell would go, oh no, that could be a problem. We're going to leave that. We know there are viruses around, but no, the cell takes it in, and it finds it when it gets into the cytoplasm says, it doesn't belong here. Put it into the nucleus. And it puts it into the nucleus. So then the question is, well, what happens at this point? Because this now becomes very crucial for our discussion. We now know that you can definitely have mobile genetic elements in that fruit, and it will end up inside of a cell's nucleus. We've covered it, that ground. There's no question about this. It's a fact, Jack. It gets through. And it gets through unchanged. How do I know that? We'll go to the next study. What they did in this study is they took some mice. And what they did is they took a protein for the green fluorescent protein. You know, if you've ever seen fireflies, I live in Ohio, and that's one of the green fluorescent protein is what lets them light up at night. But there is the one that they're going to use here is the one that has to have a black light put on it, and then it glows. If any of you have taken a biology course, you've been, I'm sure you've seen that. And what they did was they took this green fluorescent protein coding area, or gene, and they put it in rat kibble, but they also included two other things. I think it was a T4 macrophage and an adenovirus type 2. And the reason they included both of those is because those guys have enzymes. They have the integrase and they have the endonuclease, which are needed to get this gene. If it can make it all the way into the cell, it's got to somehow be put into the DNA so it can be transcribed. And in order for it to be put into the DNA and be transcribed, there are no enzymes in the cell to do that. You have to supply the enzymes which come with mobile genetic elements, because they're the only ones that have that do that. The body doesn't do this. So the mobile genetic elements come with these enzymes that go onto the DNA, cut a hole in it, take the new gene, put it in, and then sew it back up again. That's the integrase and the endonuclease. So they had to include those two enzymes with the mix. And they put it in the kibble too. And they just let the mice eat it. And what they found was they checked at 12 and at 18 hours. And what they were going to look at is they're going to sacrifice the mice, and they're going to look at the cecal epithelium, and they're going to see if they can find any evidence of this green fluorescent protein having been transcribed. So that means it has to get all the way into the cell, and it has to get into the nucleus, and it has to be put into the DNA, and not only put into the DNA, successfully transcribed. And that's what they found. See all those little green marks? See those arrows? The whole gene got through unscathed, was put into the DNA in the mouse's cecum epithelial cells, and was transcribed. If there were mobile genetic elements in the fruit, they definitely could have gotten through, and they definitely could have become part of Adam and Eve's DNA. So we've solved that question. Interesting evidence which supports that MGs were fruit-born and not introduced later outside the garden can be found in what transpired soon after the pair ate the fruit. And the eyes of them were both opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. Now, the people who say, well, the eating of the fruit was purely just breaking one of God's rules, and when God comes, he's going to administer justice. Well, that's not what happened. Something happened right away, and if people say, yes, but that's because they broke the rules, well, then it has to be something physical, because if it's God who has to bring the judgment, we all know that when we punish our children, if those of you have had it, when is it most efficacious? Is it efficacious to punish them before you even know they've done something wrong, and you happen to know it and they don't, and you cause something out of the blue to happen to them and they don't know where it's coming from? Is that going to get you where you want to get with that correctional activity? Or do you come and sit down and explain it to them, and then you provide whatever correctional, remedial activity that you wish to do? Which is more efficacious? I think we all know that the latter is. And certainly God is as good a parent as we are, or better, one would hope. So something happened to them. They said that they're naked. We aren't told in the Bible exactly why they felt they were naked, but they noticed the difference because they started sowing leaves. So it must have been something marked. It couldn't have been something minor, and it was a physical problem. Even if it was that all of a sudden their eyes actually changed, and Adam says, Eve, I hadn't seen you before, which is a little ludicrous, but it still is physical. No matter how you're going to try to cut it and dice it and slice it, this is a physical problem, and it happened before God has addressed them. And if they ate the fruit in the morning, we know that it can be expressed in their DNA within a matter of hours. I just showed it to you. And the man said, now God does come. And he says, where are you guys? And he says, I can't find you. And Adam says, well, we're hiding. And God says, why are you hiding? And he said, well, we're naked. And God said, did you eat of the fruit I told you not to eat of? Now, hours earlier, when Eve brought Adam the fruit, Adam was willing to eat the fruit rather than be without the love of his life. And it's understandable. But now what does he say when he's confronted? And the man said, the woman you gave to be with me, she gave me the treat, and I ate it. The first thing he does is he throws her under the bus. If you hadn't made the woman, this is what he's really saying, if you hadn't made the woman and put the woman in this garden, I wouldn't have eaten of the tree. I knew not to. I wasn't deceived, and I wouldn't have done it. It's her fault. No, it's your fault. You shouldn't have made the woman. And then you know what the woman said? She goes, well, no, it's not my fault. You made the snake, and the snake beguiled me, and he made me eat the fruit. I wouldn't have done it. If there had been no snake, I would not have touched that fruit. You shouldn't have made the snake. It's your problem. So what does God do at this point? God says, okay, it is my problem. I did make all of these things. So now let's tell you what's going to happen because of what you've done. Now, when I grew up and as I read about the curses, this is what I, and when I read them over, I thought, ooh, boy, they are going to really get it now. And when I read the next couple of verses, boy, was I right. God's going to say some things to the snake. You're going to have to, you're going to eat dust. You're going to grow on around on your belly, and some bad things are going to happen to you. We're going to put enmity between you and the woman, and then he says, which we're going to go over in a minute, and then he says to the woman, you know, every time you have a baby, you're going to wish you never had eaten that fruit. I'm telling you, you are really going to wish you hadn't have done it. Boy, do I have something special for you. And Adam, you're not going to get away with it. You shouldn't have messed with me. You messed with the wrong guy. Guess what I have for you, Adam? It's a daily thing. Eve, it's when she has her babies. But I'm telling you, every day you are going to sweat, and you know what? It's going to be hard to get enough food, and I'm going to tell you, some of your progeny are not going to get enough food. They're going to work hard, and the ground's not going to provide it, and they're going to starve. And boy, are they going to wish you hadn't eaten the apple then. Sounds sort of like the parent that pulls out the revolver and shoots the child, doesn't it? You'd expect that from that parent, wouldn't you? Let's look this over. I was talking to Paul. I'm not very good at pronouncing Hebrew, and I don't try to be. But the word for in the Genesis 3, where he talks about cursing, and I'm going to try as a harar. Is that close enough? Arar. Please forgive me. I shouldn't have even ventured into this venue. I'm sorry. It means to bind with a spell, hem in with obstacles, render powerless to resist. I'm going to say now, let's go back and let's put this definition to what God said. Instead of having him come in with a heavy-handed mallet and say, bend over, or a strap, it's time for the woodshed for all three of you. I'm going to start with a snake, then Eve, you're next, and Adam, you're last. Let's take a little look and see what the Hebrew really says. And God says to them, now I'm going to tell you about some things you are going to be powerless to resist. You are going to be hemmed in with some obstacles that you cannot overcome, and they will bind you. You made a choice. You went for a new information system. And these are big changes, and I need to tell you about them because you'll be blown away. And we are told in the New Jerusalem there will be no pain there. So the discussion with Eve, what he's taking is what most of us, I think, would agree is, well, there's an argument whether it's a kidney stone or a birth, which is more painful. But I'll go with God on this one. I'll defer to him. He picked the most painful incident that's going to happen to humanity, and he uses that as an example of what is going to be new. You guys are going to experience pain, which is a G-couple protein, by the way. Don't forget that. He says, you're going to experience pain. And to Adam, he says, something's going to happen to the ground. You aren't going to be able to eat. And then he also says something to the snake. Now what we're going to do for the rest of the time is we're going to go look at this. We're going to drill down and we're going to see from an information system point of view what could have been going on here or what appears was going on here. God starts with a serpent. Remember, we went like this. Adam says, no, it's the woman. Woman said, no, it's a serpent. So now the serpent's there, and the serpent's strangely silent now, not talking. Chattering away earlier, doesn't say a word now. So God says, okay, I'm going to start with you. I'm going to start with the serpent. That's where the bouncing ball ends, and we're going to bounce it right back up again. And the Lord said to the serpent, because you have done this, you are cursed above all cattle and above every beast of the field. On your belly shall you go, and dust shall you eat all the days of your life. Okay, we're going to talk about this at length here in just a moment. So I'm just trying to make you look at particular parts of this verse that we're really going to be looking at carefully, and that's going to be number one. We're going to look at that next. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. Okay, so two things. And then he says, it shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. Early Hebrew did not have pronouns like he and she, so they just put it in. And we know that we referred this to Christ, that Christ will bruise your head and you will bruise his heel. Is what he's saying to the devil is, and don't think you're going to win this war. Don't think you're going to win this battle. I'm going to tell you at the end. I'm going to go fast forward to the very end. You're going to lose. I'm going to do three. First to the snake, you're going to go on your belly. But the last two were said to the devil. The stuff you put into Adam and Eve, the stuff they ingested, I'm going to step in. It's not going to be able to have a free reign, do whatever you thought it was going to do, whatever you engineered it to do. It's not going to do it. I'm going to step in, and there's going to be a modification. And at the end of the day, I'm going to win this, just so you know. And you won't exist anymore. That was a pretty heavy, that one was facts, but it was pretty heavy. That was a pretty heavy load to unload. Okay, let's talk about Hox genes. Now, Hox genes, we could talk about Hox genes for 45 minutes. I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to make some broad statements. And as we're reading through this stuff, I think a lot of the information, too, can come across. Human beings have somewhere, I think it's about 19 or 20 Hox clusters. And these clusters are very important because they determine what we look at. They determine that we have two arms. They determine that our arms are about the same length, that we have 2 feet, that our feet are about the same length. Have you ever wondered that? How your feet know to go to be the same length or close to it? I know there's variances. I've got a hand that's a fourth of an inch longer than the other. But generally speaking, within a ballpark, we're basically symmetrical. It also will determine that you have 2 eyes, that you have a head, that you have a mouth and a nose, and the head sits on your shoulders. It is the blueprint, if you will, for a human being, for the general skeleton human of the human being. It lays out what you're going to look like. And the way a fetus develops is that, you know, when the egg and the sperm meet, it goes through some rapid divisions, and we're going to come to a very interesting part here in a moment. It stops at 8, but then it goes on to the blastocoel form. And when it gets into that area, the Hox genes start going. At this point, they're stem cells. They're non-differentiated cells. They can become anything, and then they begin to differentiate. And what calls out the differentiation is the Hox genes. The other important thing to remember is that the Hox genes are like... they're directors of a symphony. They're like the director of a symphony. All of the members of the symphony who have musical instruments consider them protein-coding areas or genes. And the conductor is up there, and he or she is directing and making music, in charge of coordinating the music, at least. All of those instruments could play on their own, but you wouldn't hear Beethoven's Ninth. You would hear something else. Cacophony. So in order for you to hear Beethoven's Ninth, there has to be a conductor who sits everyone down, starts them, and stops them. and does order. And he may say to the flutes, you come in now. And then he'll say over here to the cello, you come in now. And he points. And all of these go off and on. Seldom see a concert where one instrument plays the whole time. You can, but most of the time they come in and out. And that's how a baby is formed. It's like when you have when you're making a souffle. Timing is everything. Okay? You're off a little bit on your souffle, it isn't a souffle anymore. It fails. That's the same way a fetus is. If the timing isn't perfect, if the conductors aren't in perfect order, and you might think of them as 19 different conductors, and one of them steps up, then the next one goes, because that's how the Hox genes work. Number one starts, two, three, four, all the way down. They go in order. And so it's posteriorly dominant, meaning when the next guy gets up, the guy that was there before sits down automatically. There's no complaints. And he takes over, or she does, or it does. And that's how you make a baby. It's timing. And it's using the same 22,500 genes, roughly, to do it. You can think of the genes as piano keys on a piano, and you could also think of the Hox genes as a piano player. It doesn't matter how you want to make your analogies. So that's why these Hox genes are very important, or we would all look very different if we were alive at all. Hox genes are central to the specifications of structures along the anterior posterior body axis, and modifications in their expressions have paralleled the emergence of diversity in vertebrate body plans. Here we describe the genomic organization of Hox clusters in different reptiles and show that squamates, that's snakes and lizards, that family, have accumulated unusually large number of transposable elements at these loci in the Hox genes, reflecting extensive genomic rearrangements of coding and non-coding regulatory regions. Extensive. Let me tell you something. I'm going to show you. This is the next one. No. I'm going to show you a minute, compare between a human being and a squamate, and show you the difference in the how much the Hox gene area clusters have been infiltrated by mobile genetic elements. This atypical structure of the Hox gene clusters suggests that a strong constraint was lost within this order of animals. This is the same paper I'm quoting. This is just down further. Permitting repeats to invade loci that are otherwise resistant. In squamates, mobile genetic elements have been able to do something that they have not been able to do anywhere else in any other DNA-based organism, and that is they have invaded the Hox gene system drastically. They have completely remade what snakes look like, and I'm going to quote from people who don't believe in this record, and they'll tell you that. If you look at this slide, if you see the yellow, it says cervical there, and then blue is thoracic dorsal, and I don't know if it's red. Yeah, red is lumbar, and then green is caudal. Did you see that? Those are those colors determine the areas that the numbered Hox genes, which you see. There you see a rat on my right, and a snake on my left, a reptile. If you look at the colors, the numbers are just the numbers of the different Hox genes, and the ABC has to do with where it goes, if it's anterior to posterior to anterior. So these are just telling you at what part of this organism, what specific part is that, if you want to take it like a band across, is that Hox gene responsible for, and it's actually layered from posterior to anterior if the organism is laying down flat. So it's that well segmented. This is not just by gosh and by golly type of a system. It is very precise. It would have to be. How else could we have arms that don't, one doesn't grow a foot longer than the other. It has to be very precise. Now, if you look at the snake, there are just a few cervical vertebrae. And then you have a whole long list, line of thoracic vertebrae with ribs. There is no lumbar in the snake, and there is in the rat, as you can see. And actually, where it says the caudal, there is in the snake a remnant of a sacrum. And it also has what appears to be two buds on it, which scientists believe were the buds that would have formed feet. But they don't form them. You see that? And that is solely because the Hox genes have been so thoroughly invaded in the snake. But it gets worse. Or better, how you want to look at it. Transposable elements are indicated with asterisks of different colors. Now, blue is for DNA transposons, and we don't want to go into the difference between transposons and retrotransposons. For now, just let's look at them as mobile genetic elements. If you look at the slow worm and the corn snake down there, the boxes which has 13 on it, and then 11, and then 10, those are Hox, those are Hox genes. Hox gene clusters. Do you see all of the red and the light blue in those? Now go up to the human. Look at 13, 12, 11, and 10. You see some white areas, but the white areas do not indicate mobile genetic elements. They indicate that there is a difference between them and, say, the corn snake. They have different coding at that point. You don't see any color in the human, do you? I want to make sure as I look at the slide that, yeah, came through that way. Look at the colors that you get down there with the squamates. They're riddled with it. In fact, most of the Hox gene has been nested by mobile genetic elements. A majority of his mobile genetic elements. Same paper. Here we describe how structural and regulatory adaptations in this gene family may have accompanied the transition towards such a body plan and suggest that the unexpected invasion of all squamata Hox clusters by transposons might have facilitated such adaptations. This is from a paper, December of 2013, which would be a month ago. Well, now 2 months ago. And they looked at the cobra snake, and I don't want to, because time is flying, I don't want to take time to go through this slide, except to say that they validated the same thing they found in the corn snake, that with snakes in general, the reason the cobra looks the way it does is because its Hox gene clusters have been infiltrated and acted upon in the same way as all of the other snakes. They just happened to pick the cobra to validate that maybe the corn snake was an anomaly, and we better go and look and see if there is, in fact, this is across the line, and it is. It says the king cobra Hox gene, as in other vertebrates, were found clustered at four distinct genomic loci, but the gene clusters are substantially larger than in mammals, with a 10 to 40% increase in size. That's big. That's all mobile genetic elements. This expansion in size was mainly due to the presence of repeated elements, that's mobile genetic elements, a peculiarity that seems to be a genomic synapomorphy, which means it's something that is unique to this to the squamata. Other squamata reptiles, a similar observations have been described in the corn snake and the Aenolis lizard and have not been reported in other vertebra taxia. So only the reptiles, and specifically the snakes, have been hit by far the worst. Not even close. There's no one else in the game when you want to look at the amount with which they've had Hox infiltration. This type of body plan is characterized by a greatly increased number of vertebrae. This is from lizard to snake behind the evolution of an extreme body plan. A reduction of skeleton regionalization along the primary body axis and loss of limbs. Got that? Loss of limbs. Recent studies conducted on both mouse and snakes now hint at how changes inside the gene regulatory circuitries of the HOX genes and the somatogenesis clock, remember clock, that's timing, that's getting the different genes or the protein coding areas to come together in a perfect symphony to make what you're, the organism that you're going after. Recent studies have conducted on the mouse and snakes have now hint at how changes inside these gene regulatory circuitries of the HOX genes and the somatogenesis clock likely underlie these striking departures from standard tetrapod morphology, suggesting scenarios by which snakes and other elongated species may have evolved from more ordinary bodied ancestors. So they're saying that snakes weren't always this way. They had a body habitus, in their opinion, more like the rest of the vertebrates. Interestingly, the accumulation of transposable elements within the squamate HOX clusters, absent from their mammalian counterparts, notice that, may have caused the disruption of the regulatory modules. Well, and actually, here we're going to get to a case in point where we will show that they do. Axial patterning in snakes and Sicilians, evidence of for an alternate interpretation of the HOX code. Now, if you notice at the very top where you see the letter F, and then you see the chicken, and you notice as you go down that black line, it bulges out, and you see a wing bud, and then it comes back in, and it keeps going down. And at the bottom, you see a HOX B9, and it's red in yours, it's purple in mine. Okay, we'll go with red. And then next to it, you see the TBX5. I call it T-Box 5. It's blue. This is a time. This is following time. Time is going down from top to bottom. So at the very top is the beginning of what we're watching. As time goes on, we see a wing bud form in the chicken at the time the T box 5 gene is activated, and then when the HOX B9 turns on, when the T box 5 gene stops, and we have a continued progression in the animal. Now let's look at the snake. The snake has the T-box 5 gene starting at the very top, at the very beginning of this time frame. It's already running. And notice it runs the entire course of the time frame that we're looking at. Remember how things start and stop are so very important. The HOX B9 gene starts when it's supposed to, but notice the wing bud doesn't form in the snake. Now here's the key. The snake has all the genetic information there to form a wing bud. It just doesn't do it. Snakes used to fly. Why do you think they think that reptiles were the progenitors of modern day birds? Because reptiles have the genetic code to make wings. They just don't do it because their HOX gene clusters that would allow that to happen have been infiltrated, and it doesn't get turned. Those HOX genes don't turn it on. Now it's even more interesting because the TBX5 gene is important for the development of the heart, and it's also important for the development of the arm, the upper extremity. And in humans, if you find someone that has a congenital anomaly with the hand, you immediately look at the heart because you're probably going to find an anomaly there too. It's the TBOX5 gene that's taken a hit that probably has a mutation. So, in the snake, the TBOX5 gene starts way earlier than it's supposed to, and it has to run the entire course of the screen. The reason is because the snake has a very difficult time forming a heart. And when it does form a heart, it's a three-chambered heart. It's not a four-chambered heart like we are. But it starts to form a four-chambered heart, but it stops just before it forms the interventricular septum that is present in ours, and so it ends up with three chambers instead of four. And the reason why? Because mobile genetic elements have affected the Hox gene, which makes that part of the heart. It's now been knocked out. Why is that important? If the TBOX5 gene doesn't run the entire time, the animal has no heart and would not survive. So there's only one option for the snake. It's to run the TBOX5 the whole time, but in the process of doing it, it throws off the choreography for the arm or for the wing bud. And the same is also true down further with the Hox genes dealing with the caudal area. So the legs are knocked off the lower part of the snake, and the wings are knocked off the upper part of the snake because it's been grossly infected with mobile genetic elements in the Hox genes themselves, and is even to the point that the snake is very precarious. If you look if you open up the thoracic area up here where the snake has its heart. So let me just jump ahead. I'm going to say that God was saying to the snake, in order for the snake to even survive now because of what you've ingested, we're going to have to run your TBOX5 gene continuously, and you're no longer going to have wings, and no longer are you going to have feet. You're going to have to slither around on the ground. You're going to have to eat dust. It wasn't God's idea. He didn't think of some clever way to really get back at the snake. This is cause and effect. Because cis-regulatory modules may be carried around by transposing mobile elements, and because the transposition of mobile elements is the most rapid type of large-scale genomic sequence change in animal genomes, this is likely to be the major mechanism for gene regulatory networks. And it is clear that we have seen great bursts of mobile element insertion in the evolutionary history of many animal lineages, including our own. I'm going to suggest to you that this may be the main way speciesation occurred. Just a thought. That's another lecture. The TBOX5 gene, deeply embedded in the vertebrate heart formation of the gene regulatory network, turns out to be regulated differently during heart formation in reptiles than in birds and mammals. And that's just what I told you. Okay? So I told you we were going to go into rather depth on the snake eating dust. But what was the second part of that, of the text? It talked about, I'm going to put enmity between your seed and her seed. You and this woman will hate each other, and your descendants and hers will always be enemies. One of hers will strike you on the head, and you will strike him on the heel. This is the contemporary English version, and this is the interpretation that's widespread throughout Christendom as to what that text means. I beg to differ totally with this. The adversary does not have descendants. All of the descendants come from the woman and Adam. So why isn't Adam mentioned in this? Why is just the woman mentioned? Let's go and read it again, the genomic view. And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed, mobile genetic elements, the devil put in, and her seed, the original genetic material, and it shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise its heel. Okay, this is a very, very different reading of the text. So let me now provide why I think that's the case. Remember, why would God just pick out Eve here? Why not pick out Adam and Eve and say, and by the way, your children, Adam and Eve, are always going to fight with, well, the devil doesn't have any children, but metaphorically speaking, the devil, the people that the devil is able to win into his ranks, and you guys aren't going to get along. Doesn't say that. He makes a completely different statement. It takes a lot of interpretation to get there. And I'm not arguing that that may not be a fact in most of history, but I don't think this is the text that proves it. The word zera is what is used here in the text. And it stands for seed sowing or semen virile. It's as close as you're going to come in Hebrew to what we would call a genome. Now, the other words could have been used there if it was just offspring, if we're just talking posterity there. They should have used nin, or they should have used neked. There's small changes in those words, and we translate all of them seed. But in Hebrew, there are actually six different words that we would all call seed. Now, if you go to Greek, the Greek has one word, sperma, where we get the word spermatozoa. Okay, and if I think that's about as close as we're going to come in the Greek to talking genetic material. Not that they knew there was genetic material, but as close as their concept of as close as we can get to go. Mother maintains methylation marks. A DNA methyltransferase has been identified that plays a role in maintaining the methylation status of imprinted genes. Interestingly, although expressed in the unfertilized egg, this enzyme functions only during one round of replication in an 8-cell embryo. Now, I think this is fascinating, and I would love to spend longer. We can't. I'm going to have to just tell you some stuff real quick, and because time is always my enemy, and today is no different. What happens when the cell, after they have sperm impregnates an egg, is that it divides four times till you get 8 cells. Okay, they have 8 cells there, and then everything stops, and something amazing happens in each one of those cells. The chromosomes line up like soldiers. And then the next thing that happens is the chromosomes, there's all of the histones that are around them come off. They're naked. Histones are protein covering that's usually around certain parts of the genome. And then what happens is all the methylation. Now the methylation, I want you to think of those as a lock and a key. When something is methylated, that means it's locked down. It can't be transcribed, usually. There are some exceptions to that, yes. And let's leave those alone. They're minor exceptions. Today we're going to talk in generalization. And generally speaking, if you're methylated, you're locked down. You cannot be read. Okay, you cannot be transcribed. All of the methylation on all of those chromosomes comes off. Now they're completely naked. All of the methylated areas that they inherited from mom and dad come off. And then something very interesting happens. I think my next slide does it. The mighty peewees defend the germline against genome intruders. Peewees is the name given to that methyltransferase that is present only in the mother's egg. And I'm quoting, in recent years, peewee proteins were recognized as having the potential anti-mobile element activity. And what they do is, early clues to the nature of the maternal factor came from observations that peewee proteins are essential for transposon silencing. That's what they do. They silence transposons. In the context of several models of hybrid dysgenesis. Moreover, both peewee and the AUB are maternally deposited and accumulate in the polplasm, the specialized cytoplasm at the posterior end of the developing embryo that give rise to the future germline. So that's where the action is, the germline or the cells that are going to, for one thing, going to form gametes in this in the new baby, whether it's going to be the ova or sperm, and things of that nature. What do these peewee proteins do? Well, they have an extremely important job. Small RNAs present in the maternal germ cells, notice maternal, I'm going to point that out, are also faithfully transmitted to progeny. However, since the sperm discards most of its cytoplasm post-mitotically, similar species are likely not paternally inherited. The sperm is only a protein coat around the male genome and a few messenger RNA and microRNAs that come along. That's it. There isn't room for this large protein or the AUB protein, which augments it. Okay, you don't have room in the sperm head to do it. Okay, what do these proteins do? Well, under the direction, well, I better read this and then I'll tell you what they do because I want to get one thing in here. This gives rise to clear differences in the embryonic content of peewee interacting RNAs, depending upon whether an element was maternally or paternally inherited. And these differences correlated perfectly with the ability of progeny to silence the dysgenesis-inducing transposon. That these studies demonstrated that differences in the inheritance of material small RNA populations underline hybrid dysgenesis. They also highlighted the broader conclusion that maternally inherited small RNAs are required to prime resistance pathways at each generation in order to effectively silence at least some of the mobile genetic elements, and the presence of the sequences within the peewee interacting RNA cluster corresponding to a particular element may not alone be sufficient to achieve effective silence in the absence of maternal small RNAs. Now, there's a big mouthful there. Let me just cut it down. What happens is this protein that sits in the mother's ovum is a big protein, and it methylates down the mobile genetic elements. What happens is there's three enzymes that start at the beginning of each one of these chromosomes and start going down. They do the 3.2 billion base pairs in blinding speed. They go down and they remethylate at certain parts only transposable elements, and they do it. It's almost identical across humanity. It's as if God cleans the slate and says, I'm going to take a portion of the mobile genetic elements and we're taking them out of play. Everyone gets to start the same. So if you're getting a lot of methylation from mom or dad, that goes. And the other important thing here that you got to remember is that when the methylation occurs, no one knows how these enzymes know exactly where to put it. If they don't do it, let's say we go in there and we stop this from happening. There is no fetus, there is no embryo. The thing shuts down and dies immediately, within hours. If the mobile genetic elements aren't silenced that are programmed by the peewee protein and the microRNA from the mother, there will be no baby, period. So this isn't just a cosmetic thing. This is period. Now, you remember Molly, the clone sheep? You know why Molly died? When she was cloned, she was already well advanced in age and she died there. It's because Molly was taken from a somatic cell which had methylation in areas which occur with aging that we talked about last week. Important areas get methylated down in the body's attempt to stop the mobile genetic elements. They start methylating around them, and they methylate on important genes, and that's what causes us to age. Remember that? That's why she didn't make it. If the researchers had a way to go in there, take the somatic cell, strip it down like I just told you, activate the peewee system, and go ahead and remethylate her just with a starting methylation, she would have lived a normal life span. This is only in the mother. It's not in the dad. And if the mother doesn't have this, there is no progeny. So you got to thank your mother. Mother's Day is coming up in a while. You better thank your mother if for no other reason, she gave you a chance to survive. She carried the information that was necessary to stop the mobile genetic elements, which would have certainly precluded your birth. And now, I know we took some time on the serpent, but I had to show you there was a lot of genetic information on this, and I can guarantee you I left more on the cutting floor than I presented to you today. And to the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In sorrow you shall bring forth children, and your desire will be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And as I said earlier, what we meant was, you know, Eve, when you have a baby, you're going to wish you hadn't done this. And to the woman he said, this is the NIV, I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. pregnancy and birth. Transposon-mediated rewiring of gene regulatory networks contributed to the evolution of pregnancy in mammals. We explored the gene regulatory landscape of mammalian endometrial cells using comparative RNA-seq and found that 1,532 genes were recruited into the endometrial expression in placental mammals, indicating that the evolution of pregnancy was associated with a large-scale rewiring of the gene regulatory network. About 13% of recruited genes are within 20 kilobytes of a eutherian-specific transposable element, MER20. These transposons have the epigenetic signatures of enhancers, insulators, and repressors, directly bind transcription factors essential for pregnancy and coordinately regulate gene expression in response to progesterone and cyclic AMP. We conclude that the transposable element MER20 contributed to the origin of a novel gene regulatory network. This is a whole regulatory network dedicated to pregnancy in placental mammals, particularly by recruiting the cyclic AMP signaling pathway into the endometrial stromal cells. There's all kinds of information here. You know what this tells you? I will fill in some of the blanks here. Because of mobile genetic elements, women have a progesterone G-coupled protein inserted into their endometrial stromal cells, which make them available for menstruation. Without that, you won't get menstruation. They have coded in menstruation. This was mobile genetically coded for. No one argues with that. So at a time in the past, before the mobile genetic elements came in, women didn't go through menstrual cycle. But it even gets, we've just started. There is a broad consensus that many of the genetic changes underlying the evolution of morphology occur by the stepwise modification of individual pre-existing cis regulatory element modules. However, it is questionable whether the origin of complex novelties, such as the origin of a new cell type, you get that, new cell type. This author is going to tell you that mobile genetic elements have gotten gene regulatory networks which have produced a new cell type, which involves the recruitment of hundreds of genes, can be achieved by these small-scale changes. What he's referring to, mutations. And he's talking about how can we do it then. Our findings indicate that the gene regulatory network was rewired in placental mammals during the evolution of pregnancy, a reorganization partly mediated by the transposable element MER20. And there's other transposable elements who have been implicated that do the rest of it. These findings strongly support the existence of transposon-mediated gene regulatory innovation at the network level. What does this tell you? Well, it tells you without mobile genetic elements, there wouldn't be a placenta, there wouldn't be a syncytial trophoblast. Those are entirely coded for by pseudogenes, which are brought in by mobile genetic elements. And I didn't put up the papers where the scientists have been looking at that say, well, maybe humans used to be like the kangaroos, marsupials. Live birth, they say, is something that came along sort of late in the evolutionary pathway, and it was due to mobile genetic elements. Now, that should ring a bell when God said you're going to now have pain in childbirth, or you're going to have pain when you bring forth children. The human placenta, unique in its active expression of retroviral sequences that are not expressed in other tissues. And that's important. We're going to come to this in a second. This is very important. They have some special retroviral mobile genetic elements that you aren't going to find anywhere else in the body. They only show up in the placenta. May hold the key to an improved understanding of the functional significance of human endogenous retroviruses. That's another name for mobile genetic elements. In this review, we discuss the contribution of retro elements, particularly HERVs, to the placental function and dysfunction. And as you might guess, why we get eclampsia and preeclampsia. If you think mobile genetic elements, you would be right. Retroviruses in the placenta. The close apposition of the uterine and placental tissues creates a site for viral transmission from mother to fetus. By this path, a heterozygous endogenous retrovirus in the mother could potentially colonize all of a mother's offspring, not just the 50% that are inherited by Mendelian means. For this to be an effective route of ongoing contagion, viruses transmitted from mother to placenta must sometimes reinfect somatic or germ cells of the fetus or mother before the placenta is discarded at delivery. What is it saying here? What they're saying is this. If you could find a way to get a human fertilized egg into a woman's uterus, and you were able to engineer so that that early zygote had no mobile genetic elements, it would be absolutely impossible for that baby to go to gestation and be born without being riddled with them. So, just let's think out loud for a minute. Who do you think would have a vested interest if they knew that the remedy for the human race was going to come through a human mother? Who would have a vested interest to change the way women have children? To make 100% certain that all the progeny, every human baby that is born of a human mother, would be infected with mobile genetic elements. There is no option, because the syncytial trophoblast, which covers the fetus and keeps the fetus from being rejected from the mother because of the HLA. Oh, by the way, HLA is probably, those antigens are probably mobile genetic elements driven pseudogenes that were brought in. The evidence isn't fully out yet, but the when you look at the what they have found, that so far most all the HLA that they've looked at have come in from pseudogenes. So the mother would reject that baby without the syncytial trophoblast. And the syncytial trophoblast can only be produced by mobile genetic elements, and it, the syncytial trophoblast, is a wild exporter of mobile genetic elements. It puts it into the amniotic fluid, so that baby will be bathed in them, and every part of that baby will be exposed to them at all levels of its development, or her, its development. Birth equals infection. It's a common pathway. You would almost think someone engineered it, thinking, well, I'm going to change the way women have babies, and that way if anything comes through this, they're going to be under my control. Or at least I'll get all of my mobile genetic elements into them. I don't know if the Catholic Church knew this when they, in the 1850s or 1880s, said that Mary was without original sin. I don't know if they already had pre-knowledge of this. I don't know. But that's one way to get around it. But then, of course, then you're going to have that problem with Mary and her mother. So you've just kicked the can down the road a little ways. Behold, I was shaped in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. NIV, surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. I have no problem with that statement at all. Other things that are interesting, I'm not going to spend a lot of time, is just to say that the ability to form a syncytium, which means it's a cell which the cell barriers between a number of cells melt away and the cells become one long cell with multiple nuclei. Muscle cells are a good example of this. Cells in the cornea are another good example of this. And then, of course, the syncytial trophoblast, which is what is the sac that the baby resides in, is the classical example of this. Without this ability to form syncytium is found elsewhere. And some of the geneticists say, well, here's proof that mobile genetic elements really do provide a function to the body, because we wouldn't have muscle cells like we do today. Well, my answer to that is, how do you know that the muscle cells with a syncytium are actually better than what possibly was originally there before? And we know it doesn't help your cornea. Yes, some people say, well, it enables light to go through, but we don't know what the predecessor was, but we do know this, that it also makes the corneal cells very pliable, and they tend to change shape, and when they change shape, you need glasses. Pain receptors are all G-coupled proteins, and they were all modified by mobile genetic elements. Now we're on the homeward stretch now. We're almost done. Now we have to talk to Adam. And to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, saying you should not eat it, cursed is the ground for your sake, and sorrow shall you eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to you, and you shall eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face you will eat bread, till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. Now, if you were here last week, I don't need to talk about death, the first death. We clearly showed mobile genetic elements are entirely 100%, no questions asked, responsible for the first death if you eliminate things like infectious agents, which are also mobile genetic element driven, or trauma. If you take those two out of the way, you just leave an organism there to live out their normal lifespan. The reason they die is because of the programming of mobile genetic elements. So we've already covered that one. We're not going to cover it again. If you want to go over that, go look over a lecture. It's labeled Lecture 3. So now thorns and thistles. This is the only one that Dr. Mike Webster and I have looked at extensively, and no one has done the research to verify what we think is going on. And what we think is going on is, if you look at in plants, where it comes to the area where it talks about, where it codes for leaf formation, there are a bunch of mobile genetic elements which are sitting right next to it, but we don't know if they're going to cause this. But I will tell you how you get a thorn versus a leaf. All it does is it changes. If you get a leaf, what happens is it goes clockwise as it opens up. If you get a thorn, it turns the opposite way as a leaf is going out, and it forms a sharp pointed object. See that? So it determines whether you go clockwise or counterclockwise. Now, that's a simple thing for mobile genetic elements to do. I mean, if they can recruit whole regulatory networks, if they have obviously done something major to the way women have children. We don't know how they had before this incident, but we do know they have really changed the landscape. No one can argue that. I have mercifully saved you about 20 articles where we could have just nailed every inch of this down. There's no room for escape on this one, none. So to actually just change the direction as the leaf comes out is a minor thing, but no one's done it. Now, people have tried to take roses, and they say that they have bred the roses so that the thorns disappear. But the trouble is, when you stress the roses that they'll sell you the seed, guess what happens? The thorns reappear. What this tells you is happening, and they've shown this to happen, is that you have an epigenetic phenomenon in this breeding process. You get something called microRNAs, which actually change the way the protein coding areas can be transcribed, but more importantly, they edit the transcription once it comes off. And they edit out the ability of the plant to make the thorn. But what happens with these microRNAs when you get under a stressful conditions, as happens in plants and in mammals and anything that's got DNA, you stress it, what happens is the methylation in the cell breaks down because the cell can't take care of whatever invading, whether it's a virus or lack of water or whatever it is that's coming from the outside. It can't take care of that and keep the constant job of keeping these retro elements methylated down, and they let go on the methylation. And when they let go of the methylation, you get all kinds of new mobile genetic elements that come into play that have been kept silent prior to this stress. And so what happens in this rose is when you stress it, the mobile genetic elements, which were silenced by the microRNA, which were bred back and forth, no longer function, and the thorns reappear. So it's not actually changing the code. It was just changing the microRNA, which is epigenetic. And I know I spit a lot of that out quickly. That's for those of you who are somewhat sophisticated with genetics. You can follow it. For the rest of you, it's just a epigenetic phenomenon that we're dealing with in those roses. It's not an actual change to the letters of the DNA itself. So I can't talk about that one. The more the better, the role of polyploidy in facilitating plant invasion. It's clearly understood now that where weeds came from, well, they came from normal growing grasses, but something happened. They were absolutely inundated with long terminal repeats, which is a special type of mobile genetic element which tends to hit only plants. Plants, their biggest mobile genetic element are long terminal repeats. We do have long terminal repeats, but nothing like plants do. And what happens with them is that we have shown that polyploidy, that means more than one set of chromosomes. I mean, we're not talking about a little bit of genetic information. We're talking about the whole kit and caboodle. That polyploidy might be an important factor in species invasion success and suggests that ploidy must be considered in any general model that seeks to explain why some species are more successful than others as invaders. And here's a list, and without going at all, I just want you to look down. It says, notice there on New Zealand under the induced range, this gives you the mobile genetic elements which have caused, and if you notice under New Zealand, the 4X, 5X, and 6X, that means they have four times the normal amount of chromosomes, five times the normal number of chromosomes, or six times the amount of normal chromosomes. What happens when these occur is the plants become like weeds. They are rapacious in the way that they go, and they will dig in, and they will start growing immediately, and they will compete very successfully against any other plants that are going around it. It's this change that takes a regular grass and changes it into a weed in its behavior. And this, as you might guess, is mobile genetically driven. By now, you probably are guessing nothing. Everything I'm going to put up here is tied to that in some way or another. First death was already discussed in Lecture 3. And I'm just going to put this up here because I know that an Adventist audience, are well acquainted with this statement. It says, there was nothing poisonous in the fruit of the tree of knowledge itself, nothing that would cause death in partaking of it. The tree had been placed in the garden to test their loyalty to God. Well, I'm in the process of making a whole lecture on this because, if we just look at it the way it's written, it says that would cause death. Well, all I've been talking about with mobile genetic elements is death, so how could I make that statement in the face of this? She makes three other statements where she said poisonous and things of that way. Well, mobile genetic elements are not poisonous. They're made out of messenger RNA or DNA, and it's part of our DNA, it's part of our framework, so that's not poisonous. I picked this one on purpose because it appears to be the most contradictory. I will just give you a couple of one-line statements right now. It actually, as you can see, has got a lot of fascinating genetic evidence behind it. I will just say this. When the devil, I'm now going to assume that my paradigm is correct because I'm going to talk in that genre. When the devil came to infect Adam and Eve, his idea was not to kill them. His idea was to change them so that they would become his cohorts in crime and that they would eat of the tree of life and live forever, and they would therefore become his base. He was recruiting his army. He had angels. He was now going to have human beings, and the idea was slowly but surely to go through guerrilla warfare throughout the universe, picking off all of God's created beings, and pretty soon God would be left alone in the middle, and everyone would say, well, gig's up now. We're taking over. And the idea, I don't know if he thought God was loving and wouldn't have all of his creation wiped out. I don't know what the thought was at that process, but it was clear, if you know, if you're going to quote Ellen White, then I can quote Ellen White, and I've got a lot of quotes from her, and where she says, well, that the seeds of death were planted in the human system when Adam ate of the tree of life. I mean, tree of knowledge of good and evil. So we have some what appears to be ambiguous statements then, both on both sides of the fence. And actually, they both are true when you go back in a forensic way and you line it up. And it has to do with HIV and why some people don't get it today and others do. It has to do with all kinds of very interesting scientific evidence that we now know. And in a way, it gives us a full blueprint of what I feel of how the devil was able to accomplish it and how he started out. But the long and the short of it was the devil didn't want them to die either. So their first inoculum did just three or four things to them. And one of them was to make it so that he could introduce retro elements at will, because that's where he's going to really make his job. The first invaders were probably transposases, which were DNA, and they do a cut and paste, whereas retro transposons do a copy paste. And a copy paste allows you to spread everywhere. So the bottom line is, this is not, in my opinion, at all contradictory to what I've told you. In fact, I would use it as a validating quote from her when you put the others in, because she makes it clear that what caused death was not being able to eat of the tree of life. That's what caused the death. We're looking in the wrong place. The cause of death was not eating of the tree of life. And you also notice that there was never a time when the tree of life was on earth, I mean, the tree of knowledge of good and evil was on earth, that the tree of life wasn't right next to it. And God already said, if you ate of the tree of life, you would live forever, right? So you could eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and you could also eat of the tree of life, and you wouldn't die. So there was nothing in the fruit, technically, that would cause death. It was the being kept from eating the tree of life that caused the death. Mobile genetic elements speed it up. There's no doubt about that, and we can show you this. But at the end of the day, the perfect antidote was the tree of life. I've given you just a small, brief overview. When you get into the genetics, it's way more fascinating, and it casts a lot of light onto how we're trying to fight certain retro elements today in the form of viruses. So when I get that lecture ready, we'll let you know. Anyway, I'm mercifully done. I usually take 2 hours. This was an hour and 45, so I've picked up steam. Are there any questions, or have I sufficiently confused you? Well, whoever's got the mic.
May I ask my question?
Yes.
I guess this question is simply more or less rhetorical, because there's no way you can really answer it. And if you could, it would take hours. But I have always assumed that Christ was haploid, which opens up a lot of implications from what you said. Can you expand on that, or simply agree to it, or say that does open explanations, or how would you respond?
I believe that Christ got 23 chromosomes from Mary and 23 from heaven. And I have a whole discussion on this. I forget which lecture it is.
I figured you would.
It's already been recorded, and it's on the internet. And I probably give too much genetic background for that. But I believe very, very strongly, and I feel I can defend it against anyone that's willing to admit the sciences, that there is only one way Christ could have been, and that's with 23 from heaven and 23 from Mary. And I will go to the Bible for backup as well as science. That one I feel very confident on.
This makes a lot of sense to me, calling it tree of knowledge. It may have been more in that than we ever realized until recently. One thing I would like to know, and that is, can you give a little more of an explanation based on the things that you've said, why Scripture, and I've got some forethoughts on that, but why Scripture said each after its own kind? There seems to be some change here, and it makes sense what you say.
that's why I said I'm throwing this out. This one I'm not willing to die on the hill on. But I'm telling you, I believe that speciation, that you could get a vast amount of speciation in a very short period of time. And I read you the quotes, by changing whole gene regulatory networks. And the only way we know you can change gene regulatory networks right now is with mobile genetic elements.
Well, what controls these elements staying exactly as they are now?
Oh, well,
I mean, basically.
What happens is that whenever you have mobile genetic elements hit, they will hit a certain sub-part of a population, and they may change it, but the rest of the population may have different mobile genetic elements in different areas, and it has to do with epigenetics, and it has to do with your environment and what you're exposed to. So in that way, the environment is selective, but it's in a backwards way, not the way that evolution would teach you. And what this would allow would be rapid speciation. Now, you remember, I don't know if you know this, but when I was going through medical school, when I was in college, you know, they thought there was maybe 1 million plus or take species. Well, then they went to 3 million, and I think that's gone up to 10 million, and I think they're saying we just don't know. It can be. That's a huge amount of speciation if we're going to follow a less than 10,000 years for life on Earth scenario. How is that going to happen? It's not going to happen with SNPs, which is single nucleotide polymorphisms. That's another name for mutation. It's not going to happen that way. It can't. You need billions of years for that. But with this, you don't. The SNP model for evolution has, if you read the main geneticist, has been thrown out, and it's been dead for a long time. And that's why I think when genetic entropy came out, that it didn't cause such a big brouhaha is because the main aficionados in genetics had already realized this didn't work, and they were already onto something else. And guess what they're onto? Mobile genetic elements. Because they feel that they can get them where they want to go.
Yeah, I think that's quite obvious in this. But what you're saying is this would explain better why they're Indians or Chinese or...
No, actually, that is really has to do with the breeding population and how much of freedom it has to breed with, you know, breed with others, and it also has to do with epigenetics.
Yeah.
One paper, which I have, estimates that if you take fair-skinned people like from Norway and you put them down into the Caribbean area. Yes, you will lose some of them to malignant melanoma and basal cell carcinoma. But in the end, it will take less than 500 years to change their progeny from being lily white to dark.
Yeah.
That's the estimated time span now to make that change. So it doesn't need...
Well, Bob, I gather that this is relevant, too, to what has been discussed quite a lot, and that is the rapid speciation and variation after the flood. You haven't drawn attention to that, but that's an issue.
Well, I think it is. The reason I haven't brought attention to this is the topic is the science of sin and salvation. I'm looking at humans, Homo sapiens,
yeah, okay.
and at pretty much the exclusion of everything else. But does it open up a wide area? Yes, and the evolutionists have opened the door. They're the ones that are, I'm just singing their mantra. I'm not singing mine. Now, granted, it's way different because I'm saying short period, and they're not saying that at all. But they're saying in order for us to get human beings, for instance, from a chimpanzee, you would have to have massive gene regulatory network changes in order for you to get a bigger brain so that we can now cognate much better than them, you would have to have massive recruitment of genes, and they would have to be played in a different way to come up with the human brain, which is another way of, I told you, pointed out earlier, they said that it creates new tissue. These gene regulatory networks can actually create new tissue, and they're planting their flag on the hill there about the stroma of the endometrium and making it susceptible to a monthly cycle and things of that nature. But the concept could go for the brain just as well. You're just going to change different protein coding areas, and you're going to have a different maestro calling those genes now to come in at different times, because genes are piano keys and we can play anything we want on the piano. This is big. This is where evolution is right now. If you read the evolutionary literature, it just hasn't floated down to the rank and file. And you know, that takes what, 5 to 10 years. So now we're finally having a discussion where I feel much more comfortable with the discussion. Now, they are not going to buy where I think these mobile genetic elements come from. There's no question they would probably be apoplectic. But the point is, they can't tell you where they came from. No one can give a logical explanation for a natural occurrence of mobile genetic elements, especially since they will be the first to tell you they appear, the mobile genetic elements appeared to be present when life first started. So how could the parasite already be waiting for its host and be all ready to go when the host showed up? So they don't talk about it, they leave it alone.
But Lynn Margulis could suggest an answer to that question. Please explain what I'm talking about.
Oh, you're talking about extraplanetary?
Panspermia. No, the invasion of simple forms by viral elements.
Well, and she goes further. I think she was the one that said that mitochondria were bacteria that got lodged in bigger bacteria and then became mitochondria.
Yeah, that was something.
I think that was her.
Maybe quite a few years ago now.
Well, she's also gone into panspermia. So that's why.
Has she gone to panspermia?
Well, Crick, you know, Watson and Crick?
Yeah.
Crick is big into it.
Yeah.
And I went to a lecture of hers where she was very sympathetic to it. I don't know if she's put it into papers. But she thinks that's.
Well.
She thinks that's a.
She's over the hill by now. She's in her 70s.
Well, this was a while ago. I think it was about 7 or 8 years ago that I went to lecture.
Okay, thank you.
But anyway, the problem with that is this. When you look at mitochondria, they will show you that they kind of look like a bacterium and then how it could have gotten in there and then changed over a length of time. Did you know that 30% of the DNA of the mitochondria is in the nucleus? And that it tells information to the mitochondria from the nucleus. So if this was just a bacteria that came in there, how are you going to get all of this circuitry wired up? And that there's now, they're actually saying that mitochondria DNA is not the marker they thought it was for following lineage because it has horrible problem with horizontal gene transfer. Guess what brings it in? Mobile genetic elements. So you see, it has completely obfuscated that whole area.
Please tell us in 10 well-chosen words.
You know that's impossible for me.
What's your account of the origin of mobile genetic elements?
I believe that they were engineered by the devil.
Okay, they're satanic in origin.
Yes.
And they're continued to be satanic.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely. I would, you know, this was not the venue in this lecture to talk about it, but we're under constant attack.
Okay.
The basic types of mobile genetic elements appear now to have been leveled out, and I'm just throwing this out. I can't prove this. This is a hypothesis in the extreme, so if you come back with information later that shows this is wrong, I will quickly back down. But I think that's why Christ came when he came. I think that's why he waited 4,000 years into the mess to come. Well, wouldn't it have been easier for him to have come earlier? Wouldn't it have made a lot more sense to come very early, like Cain, Abel, right after that point in time, clear up this mess and be done with it? Yes. But I'm going to argue that in order for the devil to bring all of his wares to bear, God would have waited until he brought out all his arsenal, and then he brought Christ. And I have the lectures already on the internet discussing what Christ's life had to do with these and what his death, there's two different lectures, what his death has to do with this, loaded with genetic papers. And so I'm not going to go through that now. I would refer you to that.
Are you familiar with Lewis Thomas's work?
No.
Well, he was dean of Yale Medical School, I understand, and was resident essayist for New England Journal for many, 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 many years. And the reason I'm bringing him up is that I personally am rather attuned to this kind of literary style, but he's quite famous, I guess, among a certain circle, for his extremely poetic way of accounting for the assembly of a cell from chloroplasts invading like alien, given amnesty, and various ciliated forms invading the cell, taking root, and that's where ciliates come from. And I just want to include for general information that if you'd like to read a poetic version of it, there's Lois Thomas, who was on the New England Journal for many, many years.
And at first, you know, when I read of ideas like that, I used to go, oh, come on. But actually, with mobile genetic elements and horizontal gene transfer phenomenon that they bring in, there's no reason why they can't bring the information from one species to another for things like you mentioned. So over and over again, what the editorials are saying in a lot of the genetic literature now is we have vastly underestimated the amount of horizontal gene transfer that occurs in the past and that is occurring today, right now. We're getting bombarded with all kinds of information that's actually being brought into our systems and into our DNA from our environment presently.
The knowledge of the tree of knowledge, are you saying that was maybe had some kind of anti of these elements that would may have been gotten from the tree of knowledge of good and evil and kind of counteracted there or killed them off or something? Or
you mean like an antibody antigen?
Right,
no,
yeah.
I don't think so. And this is an area which I hate to get into because it is so speculative. And once you get out onto the speculative limb, almost always you fall off. And I don't like to do that. But I will tell you, I hate to use the word evolving, but my ideas of what could be in the fruit are evolving, and I could be totally off. But I do think that right now, as I'm looking at the literature and what would be needed, I'm thinking that the reason why you would need a tree of life in a perfect state where all the systems are working perfectly, we don't have any mobile genetic elements, all systems are go, you are a whole person that's holy, being like God is holy, is that the only reason you would need to have that fruit and whatever in it is because as we make every week, we will be making new discoveries. We will be, if the word is changing, we will be changing. We're not going to be static up there. We're not going to be robots. And there is, when you get into gene regulatory networks and you get into the incredible crosstalk between them, one of the papers calls it the horror chart of all horror charts. You look at it and you go, I don't want to even go there. It's so complex that everything is integrated with everything else. That's the bottom line. And when you get new information brought into the system the correct way, because we define sin as bringing in information into your system in a non-sanctioned way, which would be what the devil brings in with MGEs, that when it comes in a correct way, it still has to be integrated into these millions of different pathways. I don't know, it could be, let's say a couple hundred thousand. I don't know how many there are. I'm just flat out guessing because they don't know either. They being the scientists that look at it. It's too complex and it's so integrated, it's just beyond belief how much every aspect affects everything else in the cell. Something needs to be the referee and put it into and integrate it into the system. Otherwise, you start having multiple systems that are functioning at the same time. And if you think of your computer that has a DOS system running and an Apple system and a Microsoft system, and all of it's trying to run at the same time, you're going to get gibberish. It's not going to work. So in my thinking, what has to happen in order for that organism to continue to function is this new information which has been brought in needs to be integrated throughout the whole system, which is no small feat, and whatever, however it's done would might even be beyond our ability to comprehend how something of that magnitude. If you don't do that, you will die because you have competing systems that are not working together anymore, and they all try to use resources in the cell, and you will drain the resources of the cell, and the cell will, as you add more systems, will just quit functioning. So that would be a way that you would, what you would need to have happen back before sin entered, and what you would need after. And there's also another reason why I think God did that, and that is because you could say, well, why would God do that? Well, we don't know the size of those, what needs to be done and how it needs to be done, so it may need a vehicle like a fruit. But there's another important issue, and that is we've been granted free will. I think most people in this room will not argue that the whole reason we're here is because God is very steadfast about free will. He will not bend on free will, because if there is no free will, you get no love, no loyalty, and if you stop and think about it, if your future will be the same as your past if you don't have free will, because you will be ordained to make certain decisions under these conditions every time. It's materialism. God is absolutely will not have that, because if he had that, all he would be doing would be making robots, and what's the joy in that? So having that be his top priority, what choices do Adam and Eve have in the garden that have to do with morality and ethics? Let's suppose there is no tree of knowledge of good and evil. They survived the test. They didn't bite, pun intended, and they were now living happily up there. Where are they going to have a real choice? I mean, it's a perfect, wonderful heaven, but that doesn't mean that God cannot strip from them the most basic choice of all, and that's, do you want to be here? Do you want to be here? Do you want to continue to live in this situation? And in order, that's the basic of all free will choices. Do you want to be here? I created you. You didn't ask me to. I put you in the garden. You're now living here. And I didn't really ask you if you wanted to do it or not. So guess what? There's a way out. Don't eat the fruit. So if you eat the fruit, you are showing your free will wish to continue to live in my system. And if you choose not to eat the fruit, you will just wither away. That's the ultimate free choice. You have to have that above all others. In Russia, they used to have elections where they would, you know, when it was communist, and they would have one name on the election, and they'd have a blank underneath. You could write in someone's name if you didn't like the party's nominee. However, if you were bold enough to write a name in that on that line, they would analyze the handwriting and come and arrest you and send you to the gulag, and you died there. That's not democracy. You have to have a real choice. If you don't have a real choice, it's a sham. You're still not exercising your free will, and if you're not exercising your free will, you're a robot. So God had to provide something in this whole scenario, and the most fundamental freedom of all is, do you want to be here or not? And that's available to you. Now, I know some of you are saying, but it says there will be no death in heaven. It says there will be no death, but it doesn't say that there can't be death. It just says there won't be any death.
Couldn't they say, though, if you commit suicide and then you're going to hell, that's not much of a choice either?
Well, but the point here is you're not going to hell, you're just going to oblivion. You're just not... death. You're just not... You're saying... as beautiful... There was a book written by James Hilton. It was published in 1933, and it was called Lost Horizons. And they made a movie in 37 or 38 called Shangri-La. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie. And that's four British expatriates were in India. They're being flown out because they were having all of the Indians and the British were fighting for control of India. And so they were being flown out, and the plane crashed as it was going over Nepal. And they go to this valley, which was called Shangri-La, and the four people survived the crash, the four expatriates, and mysteriously these Nepalese came and picked them out of the plane and carried them over these treacherous mountain passes to this valley called Shangri-La. And the story goes, the writer goes to great lengths to make it as perfect of an environment as he possibly can, and I'll let you read the book. But the bottom line is, one of the four expats said after he'd been there about a year, he said, and you live to be 400 or 500 years old, there's no disease, you have all the food you want, all day long you can pursue the arts, and you have the person who was trained by Mozart there, and you have all these dignitaries who they have somehow ensconced in this valley, and so your intellectual pursuits are without equal anywhere else. It's an ideal environment. And one of the guys says, I don't like it here. He says, I want to leave. Oh, the caveat is if you leave, you die in the story. And so he goes, I don't want to stay here anymore. And the main character who really likes it, he goes, why? Why would you want to leave? And he goes, well, when we go out and we're playing polo, and Chang is their main Chinese guy. He's 400 years old, and he's there. He tells them about the place and gets them up to snuff on how to live there. And he goes, he says, when I'm playing polo with him, he says, I can't just run my horse behind him and give him a whack and have it throw him off, and then I slip ahead and take the ball and score. He goes, you just can't do that to the guy. He's such a nice guy. And he goes, and how am I going to, he says, I want to get up on my buddies. I want to move to the head of the pack. And he says, here, it's really frowned on. I just don't like this. He goes on and on describing how he finds it hell there. And he leaves and he dies. So the point is that of the book is not that the author is really great at describing heaven. He's not, but he does it in the best from his perspective. The point is God has to make allowances for his creatures, for those that don't want to live there. He can't, if he's really given you free will and free choice, he just can't assume that you all are going to live here. If I tell you you all have to live here and you have to abide by these rules, you don't really have free will. Oh, you may have a free will whether you're going to eat an apple or a pear, but that's inconsequential. The most important issues of life and where you've got to have free choice in order for free will to work, and the most important of all is, do you want to be here?
So he's just going to be the taskmaster at that point. Another question. If there was something in the in the fruit of life that, I mean, is there, and that kind of carries into another question, can something control, like you said, maybe like be the maestro of these mobile genetic elements? Is there some kind of controls that are there?
Well, actually, if I had to pinpoint where I thought the control was, it would be in the environment, because they are triggered by stress, they're triggered by changes in your diet, they're triggered by viral infections. And viral infections come in, and the viruses don't even have to bring in the enzymes anymore. They're already coded for in the lion-1s. They send a message to the lion-1s, hey, we've just entered. The lion-1 fires off some endonucleases, some reverse transcriptases for them so that they can make more copies of themselves. They are in communication. They are they're on the same team. So in that sense, there is control, but in other sense, it's very stochastic in nature. It's a rolling of the dice, because you don't know how the combination of permutations are going to work. And my evidence of that is last week I talked about the identical twins, the monozygotic twins, and how as they grow older, their genomes change, and until when they're 60, their genomes are markedly different from each other, and it's all due to mobile genetic elements that have a different effect on both of those fetuses, which started out with the same genetic...
Mobile genetic elements were the same. So have like things like antioxidants or things like this, you know, where they control like oxidation of cells and what is it, kind of the bad.
They're called
elements.
ROS, reactive oxygen species.
So kind of counteract those things. I mean, you said viruses can do that. How about other elements that are kind of
mobile genetic elements are the main cause of reactive oxygen species. I talked about that last week, and they do that because they have slightly changed almost all the enzymes that we do have in our body, and they have changed them to the point where they're inefficient, and their inefficiency, without going into a long statement, gives rise to ROS, and ROS, as we know, plays havoc with the cell.
Someone mentioned haploid life. Is that possible?
I don't know, but I know this, getting back to that. Yeah, there are. There are some. Well, there are, especially if you get into the lower organisms, for instance, prokaryotes are haploid. I mean, they have only one strand of DNA that goes all the way around. In getting back to that, if Christ were haploid, then my first statement is he wouldn't be human, because we determine what you are by your genetic setup. Not by your phenotype, but by your genotype. That's how we're going to determine where you are. So Christ could not be, immediately, Christ would not be deemed human. And certainly the statements in the Bible, which deal with the fact that he's like us, he was of the seed of David, he came from the seed of Abraham, Hebrews 2, I think it's 14, says that he didn't take on the, I use the word information system, the Bible doesn't, of angels, but took on him the one of Abraham. Those statements couldn't be true, because Abraham had 46 chromosomes. And if Christ had 23, that would not be a true statement. So if God's lying here, where else is he lying? Maybe he's lying about resurrection then. Or he's saying, well, those are my terms. So I take the Bible literally, and I know I would have a lot of contentious disagreement on that. But I hate getting into the place where we have to decide who then is able to determine what the Bible really means. Because the person who determines what the Bible really means, because you can't take it all literally, is really putting themselves above the Bible and saying that they are more astute at knowing what's real than the Holy Spirit. Or they're saying the Holy Spirit has talked to them specifically and allowed them to know what really isn't to be taken literally. And it gets to be a morass and a horrible discussion, and it's not worth going there. And no one walks out convinced of their to change positions. I'm just going to read it here. It says Hebrews 2:16, for verily he took on him the nature, he took not on him the nature of angels, but took on him the seed, which is sperma, of Abraham. So if that's to be true, and I've got many other texts, one that says David and others, he has to have 46 chromosomes or he didn't take on that seed, period.
Through these years, there have been quite a bit of discussion among the Adventists on what kind of nature the Lord took on himself, fallen nature or nature of Adam before the fall. To me, from your presentation, it makes sense that...
I am absolutely convinced, and I feel I can defend this both biblically and scientifically, that it's a post-fall. And I go through this in that the lecture I have, because some people say, well, the body was post-fall, but the mind was pre-fall. That one has absolutely no possibility of occurring unless God does the most wonderful miracle in the world, in which case he's not human. He didn't walk in my shoes. He had something else way beyond what you and I have. And this whole comparison is a joke.
I think we're dealing here with the issue of free will and how free will is actually exercised. And the importance of free will is actually very, tightly connected to our identity. If we don't have the free will, we don't really have an identity.
Correct.
If somebody else is pulling the strings, then you're
just an extension of them. If they're
that's
pulling
right,
the strings,
that's
you
right.
you are it's, nothing it's like, not more than an extension.
It's like my car is not doesn't have a car soul. It's you know what I'm saying? It's not. Although these days with more computers in the car, you feel like there is more of an interaction. Yet it basically doesn't have the options of saying, well, I don't want to go there. I feel like I want to go someplace else. You know, that would kind of limit its usefulness tremendously. But you see, that essentially is the difference between an independent living agent as opposed to a mere Muppet.
A programmed agent.
Yeah. Yes.
Pre-programmed.
Well, you know the Wall Street manipulators, the nicknames they used to have for their clients that they were able to manipulate readily. You know what it was? They called them Muppets because they felt that they themselves were very clever, and their clients who were giving them money, entrusted money to them, well, they didn't understand what these guys were talking. They bamboozled them with BS, pardon me. And the clients went along because they thought these guys had their best interests at heart. And ultimately, that's the great controversy that started in the Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve chose to trust someone who they felt had their better interest at heart, rather than their creator.
What they felt, too, was that they could get a new information system. Well, Eve did. I think Adam...
Superior one.
Yeah, I think Adam realized this was a ruse from beginning to end. But I think Eve thought that, hey, she saw with her own eyes that this actually worked, and she wanted to give it a try. So the free will, that's why the tree had to be put there, of knowledge of good and evil. If God's really going to give free choice, and there's another person out there programming, we don't have a choice to have between two or three or four different programmers. We only have a choice between two entities that are smart enough and have the resources to be able to not only program us, but our environment. Because you'll find out these mobile genetic elements have completely wreaked havoc with the biome. And with that in mind, those are the only two people, and that's why you can only serve God or man. God doesn't say, well, there's a third and a fourth choice. He says there's only two choices because there's only two intelligences that are smart enough to even deal in this ballpark. And that is how to program reality and put intelligent creatures in it that are also programmed as part of the thing.
Do you feel that created beings on other worlds at one time had an equivalent of a tree of knowledge of good and evil?
Yes. Now, do they have DNA? I have no idea. But I think I'm just making this statement. I can't prove it. I'm just putting this as a presupposition for everything I say. If you are a created being, you have to have an information system. We have DNA. If you are God, you don't have an information system. Or if you do, we as created beings would never recognize it as such. So that's the difference between a created and a creator. And therefore, I think anything that's created has an information system. Whether it's DNA or not, I don't know. The text I just read you in Hebrews infers that maybe angels have DNA. But we don't. It's not conclusive, and I'm not saying they do. I'm just saying if you just read that passage, it would be suggestive that they do. Whether they do or not, I don't know, but I know that that passage would be the one I would quote that says that other created beings do have an information system, because what Paul is saying is that he didn't take the information system of angels, he took the information system of human beings to make it very clear that God was one of us. He didn't come with a different set of information that would allow him to do the things he did because of a better information system and capabilities. So that's the way I look at it, that anything that's created has to have an information system. And whether the Creator has one or not, I don't know, but my guess is he probably doesn't. And that's what really makes a huge difference if you go home and think about that, whether you have an information system or not. Because in the ultimate end, even as good as this information system is, it's got a finite capability somewhere. And when you're the Creator, if you don't have an information system, that means you would have an infinite capability. I don't know.
I have a question.
Yeah.
How do you explain the mystery of iniquity?
Mystery of iniquity? That's another whole lecture, and I don't want to get into that one because people are wanting to leave, and rightfully so. It follows along the path of what we've been discussing, only it gets much murkier. You know, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, we see through a glass darkly. That gets very dark because we're not given a lot of information, and I have to go heavily into Ellen White. You notice I didn't go into Ellen White except till the end here. Because I wanted to, for our other Christian friends who are biblically based solely, I don't need to use Ellen White at all for these. I just brought this in because it's a bone of contention, not because I need to discuss it. If I'm allowed to bring Ellen White in on this, it's like shooting fish in a barrel, because I can just, Dr. Brent Hildebrandt has compiled about, 75 pages worth right now of nothing but quotes which back up everything I've been saying, only using Ellen White's words I shouldn't say back it up. It is consistent with what I've been saying. I can't say back up. I can't say that for her. Please strike that from the record. That's misspoken. I am not speaking for her by any means. But it is compatible, very compatible with. All right. Thank you.